KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. On the program this week, the region's in-depth coverage of the guilty verdicts in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, now convicted of murder in the death of George Floyd. Coming up, reaction from the borderland and a look at the New Mexico Civil Rights Act signed into law this month. But first, in George Floyd's hometown of Houston, the reaction to the guilty verdicts against Derek Chauvin provides a sense the decision marks a new beginning rather than an end for dealing with the issue of police violence. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has our report.
Friends of George Floyd gathered throughout the afternoon in Houston's Third Ward as they processed the news of the verdict against his killer. Travis Kane said he knew Floyd since they were boys. Kane's was instrumental in having a large mural of Floyd painted in their childhood neighborhood.
You know, when you see somebody, you've been around over 40 years, you know what I mean? And he's been close to you, right there next to you. It was tears of pain, now it's tears of joy.
Kim Hewitt also knew Floyd growing up. She said she wants Chauvin to be treated the way she felt the black community has been treated by the criminal justice system.
I'm not happy until I get the time and they put him in population. They treat him like a criminal, like they look at us in the community as criminals.
The broader reaction to the verdict against Chauvin in Houston seems to be one of relief, but with little sense of celebration. Sean Roberts is a civil trial lawyer with Roberts Markland, LLP.
I follow the trial very closely every day, and I'm not surprised that the jury found him guilty of all three counts, but it was a sense of relief to actually hear it being read by the judge.
Rashonda Tate, managing editor of the Houston Defender, said there's still a lot of work to be done to address the conditions that led to Floyd's murder.
The moment is bittersweet because George Floyd is still dead and we still have a policing problem. But the guilty verdict is a start.
That's a sentiment that Houston area leaders echoed, including Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo.
While the justice system served its purpose today, there is still so much more work to be done toward a smarter and fairer and more effective criminal justice system.
And Houston's new police chief, Troy Finner, speaking from City Hall alongside Mayor Sylvester Turner, emphasized the lessons of the day for police themselves.
It's a day of reflection, but it's also a day of healing and a message to everyone that no one is above the law, and especially those of us who take an oath and swore to uphold the law and protect one another.
Just how such changes will manifest in Texas remains unknown. The George Floyd Act, a major police reform bill, has been stuck in a state house committee for nearly a month. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
To local reaction now, and I talked with Delano Lewis on Tuesday, moments after the verdict was read, guilty on all counts. Lewis is visiting senior fellow for global affairs at New Mexico State University and former U.S. ambassador to South Africa in the Clinton administration.
Well, I didn't follow the case at all. I didn't watch any of it, but I was definitely interested. But I have been watching the last hour, and I am quite relieved. But when you first called, my first reaction was I was numb. And I was trying to take it all in. And I am just relieved that a police officer was held accountable. I think that's the key here in terms of the criminal justice system working for all people, black people, brown people, all colors. The system should work fairly.
Yeah.
And this is one case where it appears that the jury heard and saw and rendered a verdict. Holding this officer accountable. So I think that's progress, and I feel very relieved.
And I know that that is the sentiment that we're hearing all over the region, all over the world now to this verdict. And you hit on this key issue of accountability because part of the attention to these cases is that accountability is so rare. Since 2005, 139 police officers have been arrested for murder or manslaughter due to an on-duty shooting. That's according to data from Philip Matthew Stinson, who is a criminal justice expert who follows this. So 139 officers, but there have been 1,000 fatal police shootings reported each year in the U.S. This is in the last more than 15 years, only 139 officers arrested for murder or manslaughter. So we're looking at a 1% of cases, never higher than 2%, where those charges are even filed.
Yes.
And so this is that issue. It's so stark.
Yeah, there are two parts to it. One is that those statistics are quite alarming, and that tells us and tells me that we must do something on police reform and the police immunity issue. I'm a lawyer, but I'm not a practicing lawyer. But to have this immunity when you go and if it is charges filed, this police has immunity because he or she is wearing a badge and a uniform, and therefore so they're held immune from prosecution. I think there's got to be some real survey and research and change here about how the system works. That's the first point. The second point on those statistics is the disproportionate number of persons of color who have died at the hands of police. Now, that is another issue, and that issue deals with our racial issues in this country since slavery. And this country has not dealt with this issue very well at all. We have not talked about it in schools. We've not really explained it or at least even talked about forgiving. This issue has just plagued us. And that has to change, that we should be looking at people as people, not by the color of their skin, not by any stereotypical view of what the jobs that they held or didn't have. So you've got the system that needs to be dealt with and a racial issue that's definitely one that we have to deal with.
Senior Fellow for Global Affairs at New Mexico State University and former U.S. Ambassador to South Africa, Delano Lewis. I also spoke after the verdict with Dr. Bobby Green. She is president of the NAACP of Doña Ana County.
Well, I am frankly relieved, and it is probably the best possible outcome in a very bad scenario all the way around.
Something you and I have talked about before, because we've done programs on KRWG Public Media about police misconduct. While this is one case with guilty verdicts on all counts, in terms of police misconduct, there are many, many cases. About 1,000 fatal police shootings are reported each year in the U.S., and only a tiny percentage, about 1 to 2%, result in murder or manslaughter charges. So this is stunning, and this is something that you and I have talked about in terms of accountability.
Well, and then the other thing to keep in mind, Fred, is that had it not been for a viral video that the entire world saw and was completely outraged by, if I recall correctly, they weren't even going to charge Chauvin in this case. So social media and technology has equalized policing to a certain extent, such that there is evidence now, which wasn't available before. It was basically our word against their word, and rarely was there ever any, even so much as an indictment, less long a conviction. So things have changed. Technology is, I always tell my students that technology is a great equalizer, and in this case, the technology was tremendously important, I believe.
Yeah. Speaking of technology, at krwg.org, your column is there for folks to read. It has been there for several days. Many people are reading about it, and you're talking about the larger issue of a concern about racial profiling that is alleged in terms of some stops of drivers, that we know that it is much more likely for people of color to be stopped. We just recently have heard of stories of people pulled over for having an air freshener on their rearview mirror, as one example. And you question the prevalence of police stops of drivers in light of this situation.
Well, I read just yesterday that there have that this past year there were over 20 million traffic stops. And a lot of the time, the traffic stops, or the fines from traffic stops, are being used to subsidize departments, and the revenue, it's like a, you know, a revenue stream, a cash cow, and usually it is people of color who are paying fines. They can't afford the fine, then there's a warrant, they can't pay the warrant, then they go to jail. The jails are full of people of color, and now COVID is you know, also an issue in prisons, and so a traffic stop can be a death sentence in a whole number of different ways. And I think that that's something that is really unsustainable. There are other cities who are looking at alternatives to traffic stops, alternative to police with badges and guns doing the traffic stops, you know, and other ways to monitor traffic and make sure that it is, that, you know, the streets are safe, of course. But it shouldn't necessarily be a police officer with a badge and a gun, and it shouldn't certainly not be for purposes of generating revenue and subsidizing police departments on the backs of people of color primarily and poor people in general.
Final question for you, Bobby, as we think about this issue and certainly the Floyd case, his death, and now the conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin. It has brought to light so many abuses. It has started a dialogue, and in some cases it has even led to some legislation. But a critic say, look, we're really just at the beginning here. What's your assessment?
Oh, I think it is just the beginning, and there is so there's a long way to go. And I don't think that this one conviction in this one case, with overwhelming evidence that was hard to deny and hard to dispute, I don't think this is going to be nirvana, if you will. I think we definitely need to take a close look at the structure of departments across the country, police departments and policing in general, and look at ways to maintain a civil society. But let's try to think outside the box, is what I suggested before, and look at what some of the other studies have shown. There's a study at Yale, I believe, and another study at Harvard, who are looking at ways to solve these issues without it being so disruptive to civil society.
Okay. Dr. Bobby Green, she is the president of the NAACP of Doniana County. Bobby, thank you so much for being with us.
Fred, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Dr. Bobby Green, president of the NAACP of Doniana County. You can listen to all of our coverage online at krwg.org, including this story. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham signed the New Mexico Civil Rights Act into law this month, prohibiting the use of qualified immunity as a defense in state court. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Government employees will not be able to use qualified immunity as a legal defense in state court under the recently ratified New Mexico Civil Rights Act. Lori Roberts, a state policy advocate for the Innocence Project, says the act will create an easier path for those seeking to bring a claim against a government body, relying on state courts rather than the federal judicial system.
instead of having to go to federal court and allege a violation of your federal constitutional rights, instead, you can go to your local district court in front of a judge or a jury of your peers, you know, a judge elected by New Mexicans, and the local governments are not able to use qualified immunity as a defense the way that they would be if you were forced to go into federal court.
First introduced by the Supreme Court in 1967, qualified immunity is a legal defense granted to government employees, such as police officers and social workers. It allows for a defendant to successfully claim immunity if the alleged violation is not clearly established, relying on prior legal decisions with similarities to current cases. Prior to the passage of the New Mexico legislation, Doñana County District Attorney Gerald Byers spoke to KRWG about qualified immunity, stressing that individual government employees need to be financially protected.
On the one hand, qualified immunity, it's a buffer between the government and the government actors and people who are civilly trying to redress a wrong. But the thing is that prevents a chilling effect, because if a law enforcement officer or other government actor were totally exposed to severe financial penalty just for an act that arose out of them doing their job, that would really chill the desire of people to be public servants.
Under the New Mexico Civil Rights Act, claims can be brought against a public body, not individual employees themselves, putting the financial liability onto the employer. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham said in a statement that the act is an important step toward ensuring all New Mexicans are given the rights endowed to them by the state constitution. Good public servants work tirelessly every single day to protect those rights, to ensure them, to safeguard New Mexicans, Lujan Grisham said in a statement. But when violations do occur, we as Americans know too well that the victims are disproportionately people of color, that they are too often roadblocks to fighting for those inalienable rights in a court of law. New Mexico was the second state to implement a qualified immunity policy, following Colorado's passage of similar legislation last year, though the Colorado law applies only to those in law enforcement, differing from the all-encompassing New Mexico Act. Lori Roberts emphasized that the act will give citizens the ability to seek financial justice in court, as well as spur additional policy measures.
It provides the incentives that local governments, city governments need, police agencies need, to actually start implementing the policies that will prevent these kinds of constitutional rights violations from happening in the first place. There's a broader accountability component that we think is going to lead to real culture change that will have far-reaching effects beyond just the passage of this law.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Another social justice issue now. New Mexico has been a leader in vaccine distribution, but experts say the rate of vaccination for some minorities has been far below the rate for whites. More from KUNM's Marisa DeMarco.
There's been a stark difference in vaccination rates in New Mexico, with especially low percentages of African Americans and Hispanic people having gotten at least one shot, compared with much higher rates for white people. This was true even though nearly half of all the people who caught the virus here were Hispanic, according to the New Mexico Department of Health's own public dashboards. Matt Bieber, a DOH spokesperson, talked about why the vaccine wasn't getting to some folks at the beginning of April.
We're seeing lower registration rates for vaccine across different racial and ethnic communities. Now, that's not an effort to blame anybody, of course.
Bieber pinned the disparity on skepticism about the vaccine.
We're very conscious that there are some historical issues that certain racial and ethnic groups are conscious of that might be creating questions or hesitancy about registration, some distrust perhaps.
That distrust has been talked about since the start of the pandemic, and even more as vaccines were being developed. So how would our public health systems head off that distrust to make sure the vaccine was getting out to the populations suffering the worst losses? Not very well at first, it turned out. But New Mexico's government needed only to look to neighboring systems, tribal governments, and the Indian Health Service to see vaccine rollout for potentially skeptical people going well. The rate for Native Americans in New Mexico has been consistently good, and the Navajo Nation's rate, for instance, was far outpacing many states.
Higher than most jurisdictions throughout the country, maybe even throughout the world.
That's Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez.
And I think it's just because, we brought confidence to taking the vaccine, and plus recognize that we did get hit hard, and in order to push back on the virus, we got to get vaccinated.
He explains their outreach strategies via radio airwaves, television and internet, and regular, reliable town hall meetings all throughout the pandemic.
An informed citizen is more likely to, follow science. And we have had folks on our town hall meetings like Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Burlov from Pfizer.
A spokesperson at New Mexico's DOH says it's unclear how much that effective vaccine rollout on tribal lands is boosting the overall rate in the state, the one that's cornering so much press attention. Months after vaccine distro began in New Mexico, the large racial gap in vaccination rates is beginning to close, mostly due to vaccination clinics in underserved communities and working with trusted neighborhood leaders, says a spokesperson at DOH. Still, there's more to do to make it equitable. Bernadette Hardy is a co-coordinator of the International District Healthy Communities Coalition. She says it's not just about distrust. It's really about access.
When I did the vaccine sign up in the DOH, it was kind of difficult. I have some elders who have no internet, no car. They can't schedule it. We need to figure this out.
The IDHCC works in southeast Albuquerque, an area that's home to migrants and refugees, a large Native American population, many Hispanic folks, and more African American people than all the neighborhoods around it. Her co-coordinator, Reina Luz Suarez, says talking about the disparities in vaccination rates could help sway some folks.
I want to protect my people. All of the messaging or propaganda about staying away from the shot, those are legitimate feelings, but it's just one more way of disenfranchising our community and keeping our community from getting what we need.
So they're working with the Healthy Here initiative through Presbyterian to create pop-up vaccination events where people can either call ahead or just walk up for a vaccine. Some of the pop-ups include free meals or food boxes too. They're also doing it by reaching out to leaders in the area.
Because they're trusted in their own communities, it's disrespectful to bypass that.
Exactly.
You never do that in community organizing, mm-hmm. No matter what. You ask permission.
And yes, vaccine distrust is a factor, they agree, though it's not because everyone's uneducated, which seems to be how people frame that conversation.
We're losing people left and right. That very system that we believe is responsible for killing off our communities is that system that we have to turn to for help. And so it's a very confusing situation to be in.
Both Hardy and Juarez say they want to emphasize that no one will be forced to get the vaccine at a pop-up. They're just trying to make it easy. For KUNM, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
To business news now, and a top analyst says things are looking good for the Borderplex economy. In depth, here's KRWG public media scholar Sarah Rodriguez.
The Paso del Norte World Affairs Council held a virtual panel with University of Texas El Paso's Dr. Tom Fullerton to discuss economic predictions for 2021's third and fourth quarter. Fullerton says recovery from the pandemic will increase the price of regular gasoline.
Is expected to increase at a double-digit rate of increase in 2021. And for the year as a whole, gasoline prices in El Paso County should average $2.22 per gallon. Anytime gasoline and diesel prices increase, it always causes the transportation costs for households and for local businesses to increase enormously.
The positive aspect of the increase in gas prices reflects a return to economic normalcy.
Even though gasoline and diesel prices are increasing, at least it's as a consequence of increased business activity. And those type of energy price hikes are the type of energy price hikes that the local economy handles a lot better.
Another bright spot in the economy has been an increase in home sales that will continue through 2021. Dr. Fullerton predicts that there will not be any major changes to mortgage rates.
Low mortgage rates are predicted to combine with local housing supply limitations to a sufficient degree to cause median prices for new single-family units to exceed $177,000 per house for the year as a whole. Not just one single week or one single month, but for the year as a whole. That prediction appears fairly safe. Mortgage rates are not likely to increase very noticeably before the end of the year. They may inch up some, but not by enough to cause housing prices to falter.
Even though universities will be returning to mostly in-person instruction this fall, Fullerton predicts that campuses will not see a full recovery of college enrollment until next year.
And college enrollments are not likely to fully recover until 2022 in El Paso, Las Cruces, Ciudad Juarez, and Chihuahua City. The demand for skilled labor is such that even though, college enrollments declined substantially last year and are probably not going to fully recover next fall, they should come back by 2022, and that's because the demand for skilled labor has not gone away.
As the economy recovers, Fullerton says consumer confidence will increase.
Aggregate retail sales should climb above $13 billion in 2021 as the job rate declines and consumer confidence strengthens in El Paso. That represents a rebound from what happened in 2020. Even though incomes increased in 2020, total retail activity, is estimated to have declined last year. Those losses should be completely reversed this year.
Commercial trade is also expected to increase in the Borderplex area.
That as global trade accelerates, a double-digit rate of increase is also going to be tallied for the number of cargo vehicles that traverse the international bridges into El Paso from Ciudad Juarez.
More COVID vaccinations will lead to increased travel, and Fullerton says that this will mean an increase in travel prices.
And as the pandemic subsides, passenger flows are going to expand substantially at El Paso International Airport. By the way, in that context, average round-trip airfares at El Paso International Airport are predicted to jump by nearly 10% to $340 per ticket this year. And, that's another one of those price jumps that nobody likes to see travel prices go up. Nobody wants airfares to increase. But this would be a consequence of a return to the direction of normal activity in terms of air passenger flows out of EPIA. That's something I think that all of us will welcome.
These economic predictions give hope for economic recovery and an eventual return to normal. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Some history this week in our regular commentary segment. Peter Goodman looks back at a major figure during Watergate.
Long ago at Harvard Law School, the tall, straight man with the bow tie, the crew cut, and the sense of humor, parking his pickup truck, was Professor Archibald Cox. He exemplified a certain kind of steady, thoughtful New Englander. He was a diligent and brilliant lawyer, but what makes this worth telling was his quiet, stubborn commitment to do right. History recalls Cox's great-grandfather, William Evarts, because when President Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, was impeached and facing almost certain conviction by the Senate, he hired Evarts as his chief counsel and survived the trial by one vote. When fellow New Englander Jack Kennedy ran for president, he asked Cox to organize professors to provide campaign ideas. In 1961, Kennedy appointed Cox Solicitor General. Cox argued Supreme Court cases, including one person, one vote, and major civil rights cases. Then he returned to teaching. In 1973, Richard Nixon appointed Cox, a symbol of integrity, special prosecutor to investigate the Watergate mess. Nixon and most of Washington figured Cox was too soft. Not nasty enough. Archie said to a friend, "I think sometimes it's effective not to be nasty in a nasty world, although it may take a little while for people to realize that." When Watergate testimony revealed that a White House taping system recorded all Nixon's Oval Office conversations for posterity, Cox demanded to hear pertinent tapes. Nixon ordered him to stop seeking the tapes. Though Archie respected the presidency, he persevered. Nixon planned for Cox to resign. Instead, Archie gave a live Saturday news conference at the National Press Club, explaining why he disobeyed Nixon. Archie, his wife, and a friend walked there from the office. It would be aired live by two networks and during halftime of ABC's football game. Archie, lacking institutional support, wondered if one man could successfully take on the president. But he did his best. Speaking plainly and reasonably, Archie awakened the country. Eventually, Judge John Sirica would order Nixon to produce the tapes, and the Supreme Court would unanimously agree. Exit King Richard. But that was later. Hours after that press conference came the famous Saturday Night Massacre. Nixon ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire Archie. Richardson, another Yankee with a powerful conscience, resigned. Nixon ordered the deputy AG to fire Archie. He too resigned. Finally, Solicitor General Robert Bork fired Cox. Right after the press conference, uncertain how people would take it, Archie, Phyllis, and a friend walked back through the city. Suddenly, Archie wanted a beer. His friend found some, but the guys behind the counter were too busy watching TV to serve him. One yelled, "Come back later, man. We're watching history here." He realized they were watching Archie and told them the man himself was right outside. They wouldn't take money for the beer. They rushed out to shake Archie's hand. Thanks, Archie, for setting us all a superb example.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. To education news now, and community college enrollment has dropped during the pandemic. But what can be done about it? More from Roz Brown at the Texas News Service.
Martha Parham with the American Association of Community Colleges says traditionally about half of the nearly 12 million students enrolled in community college are in career and technical programs that provide them with skills to immediately enter the job market. But since last year, there's been about a 10% decline in community college enrollment across the country.
Historically, when there's a dip in the economy or the jobs are being lost, we tend to see an uptick in community college enrollment. That has not played out at all during the pandemic.
Parham says students with at least an associate degree typically earn $10,000 more per year than those with only a high school education. Two Texas community colleges, Houston Community College and Dallas College, were recent recipients of scholarship and mentoring funds from PepsiCo and its philanthropic foundation to support Black and Hispanic community college students. Parham says contributions from foundations can significantly benefit community colleges, especially when combined with local agencies that offer students health care services along with food and housing resources. She says community college students can face challenges because they're typically around the age of 28, and some of those who are Black and Hispanic lack familiarity with the higher education structure.
Many of them are parents. 29% of them are first-generation college students. So if you can imagine trying to navigate the application process and admissions process entirely online.
The National Student Clearinghouse Research Center reports that in 2020, first-time enrollment was down almost 20% among Latino students. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
More education news now, and the Las Cruces School Board has voted to keep a normal calendar for the 2021-22 school year, deciding against adding additional days or expanding the time in class. In depth, once again, here's Madison Staten.
No additional school days will be added to the 2021-2022 school calendar, following a unanimous vote by the Las Cruces Public School Board. Options presented to the board included the addition of 10 extra days to the calendar, as well as an expansion of the school day by 30 minutes for elementary school students, which failed to be approved. School board member Teresa Tenorio says the district needs to explore other options to help with the student learning experience, such as smaller class sizes and more support staff, rather than just adding extra time.
Going forward, I just don't understand how 30 extra minutes a day or 10 extra days where everything else is structured the same would benefit my kids or any kids in our district, because it's not working. It hasn't worked. We need to really try something different.
After gathering feedback from the public, the district received 232 responses, with over 100 people indicating they felt no changes to the calendar should be made, the most of any category. School board member Terry Dahlman says she felt a responsibility to take into account the wishes of the community.
I'm listening to my constituents. I'm listening to our parents. We even had students writing to us, telling us that they were exhausted and they did not want any more days added on.
Hillrise Elementary teacher Delilah Morales spoke out against expanding the school year. She noted the extra stress the teachers have been under this year, stressing that instruction is continued despite the challenges of the pandemic.
We need time to breathe. Teachers have been vilified, criticized, and blamed for everything, from not having schools open to kids having to wear masks. We have not stopped teaching. These calendars give the impression to the community that the kids have not been learning and that we have not been teaching. We have been, and the kids have been learning.
One parent addressed the board with concerns over learning loss during the meeting, asking the district to expand the calendar.
My kids fell behind this past year, and I don't think it's something that they're going to overcome just like that at the blink of an eye in the upcoming school year. I think they fell behind, and if we don't supplement the upcoming school years, we're going to continue falling behind.
District administrators indicated that if the vote to expand the school calendar had been successful, the district would have been entitled to approximately $12 million in extended learning funds. School Board President Ray Jaramillo addressed the potential funding during the meeting, saying that if the state wanted to address learning loss, they could provide monetary assistance without requiring an extended calendar.
Public Education Department always talks about local control. This is not local control. This is a fake local control. And I hope that Secretary Stewart understands that when you give a fake opportunity for local control, we know exactly that's not what it's happening. If the state really, truly wanted to address learning loss, it wouldn't take a legal decision to make sure that the districts have the money to provide the necessary assistance.
Jaramillo says his vote was a reflection of the hundreds of community voices that have reached out to him on the issue.
I'm an elected official and I represent the community. And the community has spoke out to me, and with hundreds of emails, had 100% that said that they wanted no change. I can't ignore that. I can't ignore that.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Of course, the pandemic has raised many issues for school districts in New Mexico and across the country. As students return to class, many are quickly sent home, put into quarantine after positive COVID-19 cases. I recently talked with the president of the National Education Association New Mexico, Mary Parr Sanchez.
And it really taxes an already overburdened system where there are not substitutes that can step in. So when an educator has to quarantine, they can go into the virtual setting, but the workload is really becoming quite difficult. And to be in person, you know, one day and then virtual the next, and then in person or in person at the same time that you're doing virtual instruction. So it's very worrisome. Also, just for the health of and safety of the students and educators in our schools.
Absolutely. You know, schools, even though they're welcoming students back into the classroom, as I mentioned, many parents have opted to keep their kids home. What would you say are the biggest challenges that remain in schools? Because, you know, you've dealt with this drumbeat of people wanting to reopen the schools, but very quickly we've seen that there are real risks involved in doing that.
Yes, so the biggest challenges have been you know, the theory is that schools are controlled environments, and they are to a certain extent. But if you try to think of a room full of kindergarten students or more, at my level, I'm a middle school teacher, a room full of middle school students or high school students, it's very difficult to keep them socially distanced. It's been very difficult in society to keep people socially distanced, and so those same challenges present in schools, and the whole sanitation and washing your hands and all the protocols that schools have worked so hard to do. We have so many staff from administrators on down that have just put hours and hours into developing these procedures and processes for students to be able to return safely. But the fact of the matter is we're still in a pandemic, that many of our adults have been vaccinated, and many of our educators, but there are still a majority of parents that students return home to that have not been vaccinated. And so we remain very concerned about safety for students, for parents, and for staff members.
And Mary, as you know, this is not hypothetical. As you know, there's a concern about variants that are more likely to infect children who then might take the virus home to their parents. They might be affected too. Dr. Michael Osterholm, the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, warned that a fourth surge is just now beginning in America. This is his view. He noted on NBC that more than 700 schools in Minnesota reported COVID-19 cases. What are you hearing from teachers about their concerns, knowing about Minnesota and perhaps other states where we may begin to see variants like this become widespread?
So being part of the president of the National Education Association in New Mexico, I'm very lucky because I can network with teachers from other states, and we frequently do network. And you're right, in Michigan, in Minnesota, there have been variants that that are being driven into the population of students, because again, many adults or educators have been vaccinated, but the concern is really our students, and especially students of color. And New Mexico is a minority majority state, and we live in a culture that values families living in multi-generational settings. We also have many people in New Mexico, 40% of our students live in poverty. And what that really means in terms of their health is that they live close together and they live with many other people also. And those are, you know, situations that place them in more at more risk of becoming infected with the virus. So we worry, and we are seeing it happen across the nation. And, you know, I think we open schools now at the end of the year. My position and our position as an organization is that we should have stayed remote through the rest of this school year. But, you know, we will defer to the wisdom of others in that there's been a lot of work to prepare and ready schools, but for these reasons that you bring up, I don't think waiting through the summer to keep things virtual, you know, learning was occurring, it just wasn't in person. And there were certain students, you know, there are students that were having trouble accessing.
Okay, well, certainly this is a situation we'll talk about likely again. It's something that will continue to develop, and hopefully during the summer things will get better. But it's so important to talk about this because I think sometimes this dialogue is more controlled about what people want rather than what's happening on the ground. And so it's very important to get the facts out there and the fact that this is not easy. This is extremely difficult to start this up again, in-person learning during a pandemic. I want to move to some positive news, and it's related to something you just talked about in relation to poverty in our state, the New Mexico legislative session. The governor signed legislation establishing the Family Income Index, which will direct additional funding, as you know, to schools with concentrated poverty, which is known to contribute to low academic performance. Your thoughts on this decision?
So I think this is a super innovative and creative decision, and I don't know where this idea originated, if it was in the New Mexico PED or with the governor, but I do think it is very creative in nature and innovative and super exciting. And I do think that this is the state trying something new that could have a super positive impact on students and families. As a supporter of community schools, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about that, this Family Income Index could certainly provide services that a community school would, or even to hire an on-site coordinator to try to bring in other resources into the school. I'm very excited about the Family Income Index, and I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, something I hadn't heard about either until it was passed in New Mexico. We'll be watching it. As you mentioned, I know the NEA, your organization, not just here but around the country, has been a big advocate for something else called community schools. We have them in Las Cruces, where support services and referrals are provided at school. Tell me how this is going and how it's helping.
It's going really well. And so community schools are important. They do provide support services, but the most critical piece of a community school is they really elevate communication with families and parents and communities. And so there is a shared leadership model in a community school and an additional staff person called an on-site coordinator that can really work with parents in the community to see what the school is doing well and where the school may need help. So, and then to bring in resources in the areas where the school may need additional resources. So in Las Cruces, we've tripled the number of community schools. There is a grant for new schools that are interested in becoming community schools that will, the deadline is this Monday, so new grants are being offered, and we continue to work to spread this model across the state, and it is spreading. So
that's great to hear, and good to have some good news amid all of the difficulties of the last year. Of course, while there was a lot of progress in the legislative session, there's also concern as well, some areas where progress hasn't been as quick. In recent years, the state has increased teacher salaries, but this year investments were not made in that area, only a small cost of living adjustment, likely to be lower than the actual cost of living increases facing families. It varies by district, but starting teachers are paid about 20% less in New Mexico as compared to El Paso. What can be done to make changing this a priority, Mary?
So I think there is some really good news on the horizon, and it's going to be left in the hands of the voters. And so this legislative session, it was determined by both houses, the House and the Senate, that a constitutional question would go to the voters, and that is to fully fund early childhood education and additionally an additional funding for K-12 education by a slightly larger percentage of the land grant permanent fund money that funds public schools in New Mexico and has since the late 1800s when the land grant permanent fund was enacted. It's going to go to the voters in November of 2022, and the following year, there could be a substantial more money flowing into schools for the next years. And I think we have a substantial teacher shortage in New Mexico and across the nation that I think higher salaries will attract more people into the profession. And having more teachers go to school to become educators is really important for families, because the quality of that educator in their to their child is, it's just, there's nothing more important than that, than a well-trained, highly qualified person to be in every New Mexico classroom. And we know that it does sometimes come down to the starting salary.
And Mary, we should emphasize, this is not hypothetical, right? I mean, I have personally known teachers in Las Cruces who have gone to an El Paso district because of the higher pay there, and I'm sure you have as well.
Yes, I have, and it just feeds on a problem that continues to weaken the foundation of education. And I think, to the credit of everybody up north in the legislature, they understand that, and I don't think there's huge political divide on that issue. I think it is well known that we need to increase the salaries of educators, and I believe that once we can get past the pandemic, and if we can, if that constitutional amendment passes, that there's good news on that horizon.
Okay, we'll have to wait for the voters, and of course then the process, if it passes, to decide how that money is directed. Well, as you know, speaking of money, there are also concerns about stabilizing the pension system. And full disclosure, this also affects some KRWG employees who are part of that system, as university employees are in New Mexico. Some, including the Albuquerque Journal, have said that employees need to pay more. But the Journal editorial on this recently did not mention that employees already put in about 11% of their pay into the system. That's about double the national average for these types of plans. So, of course, some say that is simply not an answer, particularly when pay is already low.
Yes, our pension fund, and for educators, it's called the Educational Retirement Fund, we can kind of compare it to the PARA, which is the pension fund of police officers and firefighters and state employees. It has been considerably underfunded in comparison to that other state pension fund. And what I think people don't realize in New Mexico is that educators pay into their fund. Like you said, more, you know, double what educators in other states are paying. So, and educators have had their pension percentage that they pay raised over the last 4 or 5 years. So the ERB executive director and the board, they knew that they couldn't continue to raise rates on the employees. So they did, the bill did pass. Now it was modified in the 11th hour from 4 years to only be in effect for 2 years, but the employer will pay a 1% increase over the next 2 years.
Mary Parr Sanchez, she is the president of the National Education Association New Mexico, and you can watch that entire interview tomorrow morning at 11 on television from KRWG Public Media. KRWG Las Cruces, KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino, broadcasting from New Mexico State University.